This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, violent flash mobs in Philadelphia, a thieving flash mob in Maryland, teens gone wild, have local officials calling for youth curfews to curb crime. But do they work or just encourage police harassment of law-abiding young people? We'll ask in a moment. But first, in the midst of the economic downturn, many politicians have offered solutions for easing the impact on their constituents. But a new report suggests a group with no vote and very little voice in the public debate has lost tremendous ground in recent years, the nation's children. New data out today from the Annie E. Casey Foundation sheds light on the state of childhood well-being in this country. And the results of the 2011 Kids Count study are unsettling. It finds that the children poverty rate has increased by 18%. Since the year 2000, effectively wiping out a decade of gains made in the 1990s. Here to discuss the report is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Patrick McCarthy. He joins us from his office in Baltimore. And in the interest of full disclosure, the Annie E. Casey Foundation supports coverage of children and family issues on this and other NPR programs. Also joining us today, Teresa Falgu. She is the Kids Count Coordinator for Louisiana, a state that is working to improve its status near the bottom of the list. She joins us from New Orleans. And also with us from Mississippi, Valerie Long. She is the Executive Director of Catch Kids. They provide high-quality free health care services to children in Tupelo and some of the surrounding areas. Let me say welcome to all three of you.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Patrick McCarthy, I'd like to begin with you. One decade up, one decade down. What does this report tell us about how this economic downturn has been affecting our children?
Well, the results are really kind of disturbing. What we see is that children are suffering by being in poverty. We're seeing that kids are being affected by foreclosure with 5.3 million children just between 2000 and 2009, hit by foreclosure of the houses where their families lived. And we're seeing that children are increasingly likely to be living in homes where there is long-term unemployment.
I'm looking at the list of indicators: infant mortality rate, child death rate, teen birth rate, percent of teens not in school, percent of teens not attending school, and so on and so forth. But one caught my eye, and I'd like to get you to explain why this is included in determining who is in poverty and who is not. It's number 10, the percent of children in single-parent families. Why is that an indicator?
We use that because the research shows that kids who grow up in single-parent families face higher odds as they try to move towards opportunity. Most of the research shows that kids who grow up in intact two-parent families actually do better long-term. So we see that as one measure of child well-being. Now, it doesn't mean that all children who grow up in single-parent families are at high risk, but when you combine growing up in a single-parent family with poverty, then it really increases the odds against success for that child.
Of the states that were studied, Mississippi, Louisiana at the bottom of the list. Teresa Falgu, you're in Louisiana. One of the areas where nationally there has been improvement has been in the teen death rate, and yet in Louisiana that has not been the case. Not good news there. Why is it?
One of the major factors driving teen death rates, both in Louisiana and nationally, is the rate of accidents among teens, obviously. Vehicle accidents are a major cause. But one area of especial concern for Louisiana is our high teen homicide rate. We have a higher teen homicide rate than any other state in the country, and it's actually 2.4 times as large as the national average.
Can you tell us why that is? Does anyone know why?
Well, you know, our major city, New Orleans, has had a historically high homicide rate, and it's actually been getting worse for teens in recent years there. And so I think there's really a push locally to make sure that kids get connected to school and quality out of school time activities, and also to make sure that disconnected youth get connected to education and workforce opportunities.
Valerie Long, you're in Mississippi at the bottom of the list in 7 of the 10 indicators of child well-being, including 4 of the 5 health-related indicators. Presuming that this does not come as news to you, what are you and your organization doing? What can you do to try to combat this?
Our organization basically focus on having access to care, making it more accessible to underserved children that have barriers to accessing the more traditional facilities. We offer health care in the schools in three counties that we serve, and not only that, we offer free care in community evening-based clinics. Our physicians volunteer their time to see these children at no cost, and any medications that the children that are prescribed for the children can be filled at no cost through partnerships with local pharmacies. And then we offer dental care for those children that do not have dental insurance or state Medicaid or CHIPS insurance. So we're trying to fill in that gap between accessibility to care.
If you're just joining us, I'm Tony Cox. You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We are talking about child well-being around the country. I'm speaking with Patrick McCarthy, president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has just released a report on that issue. Also with us, Teresa Falgu, who compiled data for that report for the state of Louisiana, and Valerie Long, the executive director of Catch Kids in Tupelo, Mississippi. That is a program that provides high-quality free health care to children. Patrick McCarthy, you've identified what the problems are. What challenges do you see going forward to try to address them?
Well, we see the importance of investing in a two-generation strategy to ensure that families and kids still have opportunity. Number one, we know from all the research that growing up in poverty leads to bad outcomes. More recent research suggests that kids who slip into to poverty as a result of recession, they themselves also, as they grow into adulthood, face longer odds. They're more likely to be unemployed as adults, they're more likely to be in poverty as adults, they're less likely to complete their education, etc. So the first thing we need to do is to recognize that during a time of economic stress and strain on families, we've got to provide the kind of safety net and supports that are necessary to ensure that more kids don't slip into poverty. Some of the research suggests that as many as a third of the children who slip into poverty due to recession can be rescued from that fate with the availability of things like extended unemployment insurance, earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and building assets for families so they have a buffer against it. The second thing we need to do is to invest now in the earliest education for children. We know from all the research, again, that the early years are critical. So investing in prenatal care, in high-quality child care in preschool, and in the early elementary years so that every child is reading proficiently by the end of third grade becomes critical for their own long-term success.
How might all of this be impacted by the ongoing debt reduction discussions?
Well, we think that the deficit problems that states face and the overall national debt crisis are certainly critical issues that policymakers have to address, but it's also an opportunity to focus. And from our standpoint, you need to focus on what's most important and what's most cost-effective and what's going to build the long-term future of the country. And on all of those variables, in fact, kids are most important. The most cost-effective investment that the federal and state governments can make is in the success of children, and it's really our legacy towards the future. We really have to ask how the decisions we make in 2011 are going to affect the states and the country as we look towards 2031, 2041, 2051. What kind of state, what kind of country do we expect to have if we don't invest in our children now?
Valerie Long, in Mississippi, how optimistic are you, can you be, given the numbers that we are seeing from this report in terms of the future of the children in your state particularly?
Well, with efforts that are going forth now to increase, of course, the early childhood learning as well as to increase more access to care, I'm hopeful. It's slow, as I'm sure you know, but I am hopeful that with more education of the parents as well as just general education, that we will see a Mississippi doing better as for our children.
Well, Teresa, with the list of problems facing you as well in Louisiana with regard to the well-being of children, are you targeting one of these areas over another? Which is the most important, most pressing?
You know, I think the two-generation strategy really is critical. And so in Louisiana, one of my favorite programs is the Nurse Family Partnership Program, which actually provides home visits from nurses to young mothers throughout their pregnancy and through the child's first 2 years of life. And that program has been shown not just to improve outcomes for kids, but also for the mother, increasing employment and education levels.
I'll bring the last question to you, Patrick McCarthy, and I appreciate the time that you've given us. You've talked about this long-term kind of approach that needs to be taken. But what about in the short term? What things can be done? What things would you expect to be done right away?
Well, we know what has been critically important over the first several years of the recession and this period of extended unemployment for many families. Number one, we've got to prevent children from slipping into poverty, and investments in unemployment insurance, extending unemployment insurance while unemployment is high, is critical. Number two, again, the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, all of that is important ways to provide immediate income to families so their kids don't slip into poverty.
Let me stop you there, only because our time, Patrick, I apologize for stopping you there, but the time has run out on us, unfortunately. Patrick McCarthy, President, CEO, Annie E. Casey Foundation, Teresa Valgu from Louisiana, and Valerie Long from Tupelo, Mississippi. Thank you both. I think all three of you, actually, for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, without camp or a job, the summer for some kids can become a time of reckless mischief or violence. But some cities are answering with tough new youth curfews.
Given the technology that's out there, given the fact that there are a large number of young people without gainful employment, we need to provide our law enforcement with an additional tool in which to combat these challenges.
But are they working? We'll find out from the officials. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox.
And our last word in business today is a big number, 8 million. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued patent number 8 million yesterday. It went to Second Sight Medical Products for an invention the company says enhances visual perception for a certain kind of blindness.
The product is called Argus 2, still in clinical trials. It's a visual prosthetic that uses a tiny video camera and a patient's eyeglasses to send information to a small wearable computer. That visual information is eventually transmitted to the brain.
Patent number 8 million will be awarded at a ceremony on the 8th of September at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. In case you're wondering, patent number 1 was issued in 1836 to Senator John Ruggles, who was known as the father of the U.S. Patent Office. It was for a cog mechanism in locomotives. Though there were inventions and patents before that, they just weren't given numbers. And that is the business news from Morning Edition on NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Human beings occasionally get diseases from animals. Think of swine flu, rabies, anthrax. And while it's rare, it turns out humans can also spread disease to wildlife, with grim results. NPR's Richard Harris reports on a study about a disease that is killing coral.
Coral reefs throughout the Caribbean have been suffering sharp declines in recent years, and one of the most devastating causes is a disease called white pox.
White pox disease was first described in the Florida Keys in 1996.
Catherine Sullivan is a coral reef ecologist at Rollins College in Florida.
And since that time, elkhorn coral, the species that it affects, has declined on average of 88% in the Florida Keys, and we are seeing similar declines elsewhere in the Caribbean.
The coral is named for its resemblance to elk antlers and is among the most important reef-building species. Sutherland and her colleagues soon found a culprit for the die-off, a bacterium called Serratia marcescens. It also happens to cause disease in human beings, notably hospital infections. But the scientists couldn't prove cause and effect.
In 2002, we could only speculate that that human waste was the source of the pathogen, because the pathogen is also found in the guts of other animals.
Like deer on the Florida Keys. So Sutherland and some colleagues exposed the coral in the laboratory to bacteria extracted from sewage. And they report in the journal PLOS One, the coral got the pox within days.
So that gave us definitive evidence that white pox disease is caused by a pathogen found in human sewage.
This is almost a man bites dog story. This is exactly the opposite from the way it usually is.
James Porter at the University of Georgia also worked on the research, and he says the bacteria overcame all sorts of hurdles to make this leap.
This is a very rare and unusual evolutionary triple jump. It went from humans to the lower invertebrates, coral. It went from the terrestrial environment where we live to the marine environment. And then it went from the anaerobic conditions of our stomach to the fully oxygenated conditions on the reef.
Porter says they are still trying to explain exactly how the bacterium makes coral sick and why white pox appeared so suddenly and viciously. The good news is you don't need to answer those questions to protect coral. You can just keep the germs away. And happily, that's been happening along the Florida Keys. Jay Gewin, utilities manager in the city of Key West, says residents there voted to upgrade their leaky sewer system, not to save coral per se, but to get rid of health warnings that were keeping the tourists away.
In the early 2000s, when this was such a problem, every single beach in the city of Key West would have an advisory.
Those health warnings on the beach are now rare, he says, thanks to a sophisticated new wastewater system that cost the city more than $70 million.
The wastewater is treated to the highest level in the state of Florida, and then it goes into a deep injection well where the treated final water product is sent down thousands of feet into the ground.
Eventually, it may seep back into the ocean, but he says by then it's clean. The biologists say that since the new system was installed, Elkhorn corals have stopped further die-offs around Key West. And Catherine Sutherland says other towns along the Keys are now in the process of cleaning up their act, too, which is a helpful step.
But this is a problem Caribbean-wide, and there's a widespread lack of wastewater treatment in the wider Caribbean region.
And that's bad news for the Elkhorn coral. Due largely to the disease spreading from humans, it's been tagged as vulnerable on the endangered species list. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Just 3 months, that is how long the congressionally appointed super committee has to come up with a plan to further reduce the deficit. If they don't strike a deal, the Pentagon will be hit with cuts close to $1 trillion. All of this puts the military in a difficult spot. The Pentagon says more defense cuts are unacceptable, but if lawmakers are unable to reach a compromise, the military may have little choice. NPR's Rachel Martin has more.
First, a brief reminder of how we got here. The deficit deal agreed to earlier this month already forced the Pentagon to reduce its budget by $350 billion over the next 10 years. The Pentagon says that will be tough, but they can handle it. What they say they cannot handle is the possibility of $500 billion in more cuts. Those reductions would be triggered automatically if the Congressional Committee fails to do its job. Here's what Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said yesterday about that scenario during an appearance on CNN.
If they go beyond that, this kind of massive cut across the board, which would literally double the number of cuts that we're confronting, that would have devastating effects. Very simply, it would result in hollowing out the force.
Notice that phrase, hollowing out the force.
It's not neutral. It is something that is pejorative and intended to frighten listeners.
Corey Shockey is a fellow at the Hoover Institution and a professor at West Point. She says hollowing out the force was how the military described the deep defense cuts in the 1970s after the Vietnam War.
When the military was making a number of very important transitions to a volunteer force, and doing so at a time of great turmoil and very low spending relative to what had been expected. And so you had cuts in capabilities, and that's where the term Hall of Horse comes from.
Now, Secretary Panetta is reviving the old phrase. Panetta was brought in by President Obama to try to streamline the Pentagon budget, which has more than doubled since 9/11. But now the new Secretary of Defense is drawing the line on how deep those cuts should go.
It would terribly weaken our ability to respond to the threats in the world.
Given all America's commitments around the world, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, not everyone thinks scaling back is such a bad thing.
The country is no longer in a position where it can economically afford to function, in effect, as a global policeman.
Andrew Basevich is a retired Army colonel and professor of international relations at Boston University. Basevich argues that the budget cuts will force the U.S. government to do some long-needed soul-searching about the limits of American military power, which missions are worth the cost and which are not, delivering humanitarian relief to Haiti, helping NATO attack the leader of Libya. What about being able to wage two full-scale ground wars at the same time? Corey Shockey agrees that the budget cuts have to be about more than which weapons systems to cut and which to keep.
You can't just say, well, the F-22 will have to go. You have to say, what kinds of wars will we not fight if we do this?
Shockey, who worked as a campaign advisor for Senator John McCain in 2008, says America needs to keep its military presence around the world strong. If it doesn't, how other countries perceive American power could start to change.
At what point will other countries begin to believe that they can challenge America with impunity, or the cuts that we are making will impose greater risks on allies that are already in tenuous circumstances, and those allies then make choices that we have a hard time living with?
Secretary Panetta says he can't live with any more cuts to the defense budget beyond $400 billion. But come Thanksgiving, if the Super Committee fails to come up with a compromise deal, he may not have a choice. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Washington.
Now to a film about car racing's most legendary maverick. If you know who Ayrton Senna is, this is the film for you. If you don't, Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan says Senna is the perfect vehicle to find out.
This is a documentary with the pace of a thriller, a story of motors and machines that is compelling because of the human story it tells. Brazil's Ayrton Senna was the boy genius of Formula One racing, winner of three world championships, before dying in a crash in 1994 at age 34. A driver current and former Formula One racers recently voted the greatest who ever lived.
How do you feel about being world champion?
What is that like?
It's not a bad feeling at all, is it?
More than anything, Senna was a driver who wouldn't play the game, who loathed the politics he felt he saw all around him.
Pure driving, real racing. That makes me happy.
The game playing started with his first significant race, the 1984 Monaco Grand Prix, where Senna, described as a genius in the rain, came from 13th place to just about win the race before a controversial maneuver gave it to France's Alain Prost. Prost turned out to be Senna's bête noire. The savage rivalry between them is something to behold. But if all Senna could do was race, this wouldn't be much of a film. Though Senna drove like the devil, he was a spiritual person who believed deeply and profoundly in a higher power. A philosophical mystic with a jewel thief's nerves and a poet's sensitivity and killer good looks, Senna was an altogether remarkable human being. Senna is that rare documentary where we see nothing but archival footage. People talk about him, but you only hear them in voiceover. The filmmakers had 5,000 hours of footage from 10 countries to choose from. This included intimate home movies, shots taken inside Senna's car while he was driving, and riveting footage of frequently tempestuous drivers-only meetings held before each race. Ayrton Senna was such an innately dramatic personality that every race he took part in seems like the most intense possible. Until we see the next one. such is the power of this man and this film.
Kenneth Duran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, ever since New York legalized same-sex marriage, business is booming for planners of gay weddings. We talked to one woman who has made a career out of helping gay couples tie the knot. But now we turn the page to the latest selection in Tell Me More's Summer Blend Book Club. That's our summer-long series where we look at the mixed-race experience in America. In the science fiction novel Pym, author Matt Johnson creates the modern-day sequel to Edgar Allan Poe's only novel, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. The 1838 novel is a seafaring adventure where Pym and crew, much to their horror, land on an island near the South Pole populated only by black people. Poe's novel ends with a cliffhanger. The characters leave the black island and end up on the coast of Antarctica, face to face with a mysterious white creature. Matt Johnson's sequel picks up where Poe left off. Matt Johnson, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Man, I tell you, this was one interesting book. How it begins and how it ends seem to be completely different. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I loved Edgar Allan Poe, and he has this one novel, and the novel is insane. It starts off in one direction where it's like a regular seafaring tale. By the end of it, it's off into this other kind of science fiction realm. At the very ending of the book, the main character goes towards Antarctica, and when he gets to Antarctica, all he sees is this white figure standing on the coast, and the ice opens up in a chasm, and the boat goes in, the whole book ends, and that's it. You don't know why. Like, even if you read the whole book, it makes no more sense than what I just said to you. So it was fascinating. The other part is the more surreal it gets, the more it starts to become sort of like him putting his racial subconscious onto the page. And it's a, you know, 19th century Southern racial subconscious, and it becomes absolutely bizarre. And it just intrigued me.
One of the things that was the link between his book and yours is this idea that there is a place on the planet that black people thrived and survived away from all the other elements of the world, racism, whatever, and your characters are in search of this place.
Yeah, I think that's, in some ways, it seems like an American fantasy too, this idea of this homeland that we all have. And for some of us, that's Africa. For some of us, that's Europe. And I think what I was imagining in part was a diasporan homeland, a homeland of the descendants of Africa who came here, something that was kind of unique in itself. When I read Poe's book, he goes to this island where everybody is so black, even their teeth are black. Like, even the water is purple, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for him, it's a nightmare, you know, because he's coming with all these fears from a slave society. But for me, it ended up being the opposite. It became something utterly fascinating.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. We are talking about the third book in our Summer Blend Book Club series. It's called Pym, an epic adventure novel, epic for sure, and author Matt Johnson is our guest. Let me ask you, Matt, because in the book, your hero, Chris James, and his all-black crew travel to Antarctica, as we've already said. There are some racial symbolism that are throughout the book. One of them involves something called the Little Debbie snack. little symbols. They keep popping up throughout the story. Let me ask you, would you mind setting up one of those scenes and reading the passage for us?
Sure. Here's a scene where they first interact with these monstrous creatures. They meet these 8-foot-tall albino Goliaths that live underneath the ice in Antarctica. And they find that they actually have some culinary similarities with these monsters. Pausing for a few seconds after my last swallow, seeing I didn't fall to the ground and meet a quick death, the creature ate what was left of the portable sweetness. The sounds it made, the groans, were loud, vulgar, They were appreciative, too, and the now excited snowman gathered over his buddies. The international sugarcane trade that fueled the colonial world, these beings had obviously missed that. I watched, struggled to be culturally relative and hide my revulsion as they moved the crumbs around in their mouths, their alabaster tongues glistening. They liked the food, I turned to tell the others. They were all nodding, uniform looks of frozen shock on their faces.
That was one of the more interesting things in the book, how Debbie's snack cakes kept coming up and up and up. Another thing that kept, as I saw it, Matt, as a strain throughout the book, your main character, biracial, you, the author, also biracial. What were you trying to show there?
You know, it's funny when I'm writing and I try to show something, if I try, meaning I have an idea of what it's going to be and I put it on the paper, it's usually horrible. It feels dead on the page. So part of the challenge with Poe's book, I felt, was if he put his racial subconscious on the page, then I had to put mine. And when I actually started it, I didn't think about the biracial issue. But as I was just kind of spewing all these things out there, in a lot of ways, it ended up speaking to my own kind of struggles with biracial identity.
Was it cathartic for you to write about it this way?
Oh, no, it was hell. I mean, you know, it's cathartic now because it's done. You know, like, no, it was horrible. I mean, this book took me like 9 years because I wrote like probably like 7 or 8 different versions of this thing. Basically, what I did was just kind of put my hand into my brain and threw it on the page. And so I had to redo it again and again and again, but to figure out what I even meant. And I didn't even realize that the book was in part about my own biracial identity until the end, you know?
Really?
Because a lot of times, you know, when you're working on a project, you're working so close to it. Like it's a painting and you're just working in this tiny centimeter block. And then eventually you step away from it and you start to see the larger patterns. And that's when it starts to become clear.
You know, one thing that probably is not getting through to people listening to you and I talk about the book is this. It is funny. This book is hilarious in places. It sounds, you know, we're talking about biracial and we're talking about all, you know, history and Edgar Allan Poe and blah, blah, blah. And yet it's a crack up.
Yeah. I mean, race is absurdity, you know, and race can be hilarious in its absurdity and its contradictions. And, you know, the challenge I wanted to do with this book was to try and deal with some big ideas that I was interested in exploring, but do it in a way that was somehow so entertaining that you barely noticed that till later, you know? And I wanted you to be kind of engaged in the moment. And like, if something is funny, you tune in and you get enjoyment from it. And I find that humor offers the same thing on the page, that it makes people tune in and listen even closer.
Absolutely. It was a fascinating book to read. And of the several reviews that I read, Salon.com had the best subtitle for your book, Pym, Negroes on Ice.
I actually wanted to call it Negroes on Ice.
Really? I said, this is perfect. This is just what this book is about, Negroes on Ice. It was absolutely hilarious. Matt Johnson, thank you very much for coming out and being with us. He's the author of the recently released novel Pym, as well as the author of a number of other books, including Drop and the graphic novel Incognegro. He is also a faculty member at the University of Houston Creative Writing Program, joined us from member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. Matt, thank you very much for the book. Thank you for the interview.
Hey, great talking to you.